We, of course, are studying from Esther. And if you just change some people's names, you would think it was coming right out of the newspaper with all the intrigue and the plotting and, you know, the guys in the white hats, the guys in the black hats. I mean, it's just, it is so relevant. And these people at that time act just like people do today. And we really started seeing things kind of get heated up last week. And certainly it's going to go even more tonight as we see things moving ahead. Recall last week in chapter 4 that it kind of came crunch time, sort of, for Esther. Because, you know, they had learned about the decree that kind of Haman had conjured up. And Ahasuerus had agreed to have the Jews eliminated on one day. But that one day, remember, was almost a year away. Remember that the lots were drawn and the lot fell on this particular day, which was a long time, you know, down the road, which we talked about. Again, it seemed like God was behind that. Of course, Mordecai in chapter 4 is very upset at all of this and, you know, covers himself in sackcloth and ashes and so forth. And he then talks with Esther about, you know, your people need you at this time to kind of step up to the plate and do whatever you can to persuade the king to do something about this decree. And, you know, at first she was, you know, a little hesitant, and he says to her, well, realize that whether you do it or not, God will somehow bring it about. But you and your house may not be saved or won't be saved. And he tells her, you know, you realize, you know, with everything that's happened, and the king choosing you from all of these others, and you know, there were dozens or hundreds of them, that it, you know, it's very possible that God did all this so you would be here at this time to help your countrymen. And so she, you know, decides that she will do that very thing. So we get into chapter 5, where we start talking about how things really start playing out between Haman and Mordecai, between Haman and the Jews. And it starts with a banquet. All starts with a big dinner. So in chapter 5, verse 1, now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat on his sat on his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And remember from last week, this was a dangerous thing to do. Because if he said no, it meant she could be killed. So, I mean, it was a risky, daring thing to do. But as it says, he found favor, or she found favor in his sight. So he held out the royal scepter. She comes and touches it. And apparently, from what I was able to find out, this was like a Persian custom, that whoever was accepted, they would go up and touch the top of the scepter. So we learn a lot about Persian customs at this time. You know, this was 2,500 years ago. But these customs were extremely important to them. So, after Esther is accepted, then the king said to her, verse 3, what do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom. Up to half the kingdom. So he's, you know, it's hard to say whether he really meant that or not. Because I know some references I looked at said that this was an idiom, an area saying that just meant that he would show her great hospitality and give her, you know, great things, not literally half the kingdom, but regardless, he was he was willing to give her a great deal. So whatever her request was, if he could grant it, he was going to grant it. So that was, I think, the thing that was really critical. So this is what she answers. So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Probably wasn't what the king was expecting. He was probably expecting her to ask for, well, can we have money for this, or can we buy that, or whatever. And she's basically giving him something. You know, can you come to a banquet? You and Haman. Of course, this is where the plot really comes from. She was wanting Haman at the banquet. So, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet. Well, the king said, "Bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, "What's your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom? It shall be done." Then Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this. If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." Well, that's even odder. And that's pretty strange. The first time she said, "Well, why don't you come to this banquet, you and Haman?" So they come to the banquet. And he basically says the same thing. "Well, you know, what is it you really, what's your real request?" Again, he says, "Up to half the kingdom." She says, "Well, if you really, you know, are wanting to grant my request and so forth, come to another banquet tomorrow." Of course, remember going back to the first chapter, this guy loved banquets. He loved throwing banquets, loved attending banquets. Apparently, he was someone that really liked all the eating and drinking and all that kind of stuff. So he probably wasn't going to pass up a banquet, especially one that he didn't have to prepare himself. So, as we might say, the plot thickens. It really gets thicker here in a moment. So, what happens next? Well, we see a little bit more about the plot. So, Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Well, this just, you know, this is one of those thorns in his side that he just... it just tears him up. You know, he's got everything in the world he wants. You know, he's right there with the king and has the king's ear and gets to do all these things and has all this authority. But this one guy just can't stand him. He will not bow down or will not, you know, pay any sort of homage or reverence to him or anything. And it just eats away at him. This guy is so filled with pride and has such an ego problem that even one person, you know, 1,000 might bow down, but there's that one guy that didn't, and so he focuses on the one guy that didn't. And it just literally drives him crazy. Like it said, he was joyful and his heart was glad, and then he saw Mordecai. And then just, you can just about see his countenance fall when he sees the guy standing there, not doing anything, not bowing down, nothing. So it just, you know, like I said, it just rips through him, and you know, he was in such a great frame of mind, and then instantly it changed, because he'd been to, you know, been to one banquet with the king, and now he's going to another banquet with the king, and the queen's there, pow, and then it all starts tumbling down. So it says he restrained himself. But he went home and called his friends and his wife. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. And see, this was his Thanksgiving day in that sense. He was counting all of his blessings and look at all the things. I've been promoted. I'm all the way up here. I'm second in command. I have all of these children. I have all of this money. I have, you know, all these servants. I mean, I have everything. Have all these things. Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. Of course, he has no idea that Esther is a Jew. No idea. He knows Mordecai is, but he has no idea Esther, the queen's a Jew. That's still a secret, at least from him. He doesn't know it. So he says, even besides all those other things, you know, I get to go with the king, just the two of us. That obviously was a big deal. You know, just the two of them getting to go to this banquet prepared by the queen. So, I mean, he was really feeling good about how good he was. You know, so we see again a lot about, you know, who he is and so forth. So, but, there's that good-for-nothing Jew over there that just drives me crazy. Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. He just couldn't let it go. I mean, he had tons of everything, but this one little nagging thing just, he says, that one thing kind of destroys everything else. This one guy not bowing down to him. Again, it goes to that thing of pride. He had so much pride that one guy not bowing down was he just couldn't handle it, couldn't stand it. So, then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high. That's pretty tall, probably 75 feet or more. And in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. And this gallows, and when it talks about hanging, there's kind of two opinions. Most seem to think that it wasn't hanging, that the Persians didn't hang people. They impaled them. That was the normal method of killing people, was impaling them on a, you know, a long, sharp rod. And that's what many people think. So it wasn't a gallows in the sense of hanging. It was a gallows in the sense of having a long spike. And they simply put the person on there, which, I mean, I can't imagine that. What a horrible way to die. But anyway, they suggested to him, well, why don't you have this built, which would take a little while to build a 75-foot tall gallows. I mean, that would take, you know, several workmen quite a few hours to do. But he thought it was a great idea to have Mordecai killed. Now that has a ring to it. I like it a lot. So, things even start turning more now. It really twists around. Well, that night, the king could not sleep. And again, I think we can put this up to God being behind his not sleeping. Because, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. I guess this was maybe his way to be put to sleep sometimes. But anyway, it was brought to him, and this was like a history book of, you know, all the different things that had happened to the kings before him, and, you know, people that had helped them, and battles they had won, and so forth. So, someone read it to the king. Well, and it was found written that Mordecai had told Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Again, don't think that was an accident. I think we could lay that to God. Having that particular night, the king couldn't sleep, and that particular night, him wanting to have the history book read, and that particular night, reading the part about Mordecai. Hard to think it was a coincidence. And I think, again, we see God's providence acting to bring about the desired end. So, well, the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." We remember we read about this way back in the beginning, and nothing had been done for Mordecai. I mean, he had foiled a plot, but really nothing had been done for him. So, the king said in verse 4, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. So, at this time, the king says, "Well, who happens to be out in the court?" Ah, it's Haman. And of course, Haman had came to say, "I've got a great idea. Let's kill Mordecai." Well, what happens? Well, the king's servant said to him, "Haman is there standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king asked him, What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" Now boy, that really says a lot about this guy. Who could he possibly want to honor besides me? It would have to be me. No one deserves more honor than I do. I mean, this guy was really, full of himself? I mean, this guy was really full of himself. And that's what he just knew the king had to be talking about Haman. And all that Haman had and did and was and so forth. So he knew it had to be himself that he was talking about. So, and Haman answered the king, verse 7, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head." Notice all the royal part, stressing all the kingly stuff. "Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may arraign the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Since Haman was thinking it was him, he's really piling it on. Let's try and think of every possible honor we can. The big royal, you know, horse and the royal robe, the royal clothes and everything, and we'll get a prince to you know, take him through the city. And I'm sure if Haman could have thought of some other things, he'd have thrown them in too, because he thought all of this was going to be put on him. So he wanted himself to look good. So the king's response, verse 10, the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew." Oh, don't you wish you could have seen his face? "Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate, leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." I mean, of, you know, the thousands and tens of thousands of people, he picked the one guy that he absolutely couldn't stand. I mean, this guy was feeling, he was on cloud nine, and all of a sudden he was laid out flat on the ground. Mordecai the Jew. Of course, he couldn't contradict the king. I mean, what the king said was going to go, period. It didn't make any difference what Haman thought. If the king said Mordecai the Jew, then it was going to be Mordecai the Jew. So all of these wonderful things that he thought was going to be put on him, the royal robes and the horse and all of that, going to be put on that good-for-nothing, worthless Mordecai the Jew. So, verse 11. "So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Wow. Just can't imagine what Haman is feeling doing that. Led him on horseback, right there through the main part of the city square. You know, and said before him, "Thus shall it be done." This is the guy the king is honoring. So afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. I mean, he was in pitiful shape. He, within a matter of minutes, he went from the highest to the lowest, just like that. So no wonder, you know, he was mourning. His head was hanging down and probably stooped over a bit, and his head was covered, and, you know, just everything he could do because he was in such bad shape. So when Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." See, they said, "You've begun to fall." And I'm sure Haman was thinking, how could it get any worse? You know, they were saying, this is just beginning to fall? And how bad is it going to get? Well, if he's of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him. Why do you think they said that?
They probably heard stories about how the Jews...
Okay. Could have heard stories about Jewish history, you know, and various things that had happened to enemies of the Jews. And, you know, that would go back over 1,000 years prior to this time. Probably 1,500 years before that time, easily. Way back to the time of the beginning of the Hebrew nation with Abraham. So that could have been it. So they said, if this guy's a Jew and this has happened to you already, get prepared for far worse. So while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So maybe he's thinking, all good, at least I'll get something good here at the banquet for a little while. Just me and the king, the queen. But so the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and on the second day, at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom? It shall be done." Remember, that's the same thing he had asked, you know, on the day before with the other banquet. So, you know, what is it you want me to do? I'll do everything, you know, in my power to do it. So then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request." Now the full truth is starting to come out about who she is. Okay? Which is, you know, obviously going to be a shock, but nevertheless, that's what's about ready to happen. So this is my request. You know, you've said up to half your kingdom. She says, "This is all I want. I want my life and my people's lives. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated." Remember the decree, anybody could kill Jews that day and not have any repercussions from it. "Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." Said if that's all it was being sold as slaves, so be it, but not to be killed or annihilated. So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he, who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" Who could possibly have done this? Now, who done it? This is the part. Who done it here? This is the coming to the conclusion. Who's the real culprit? So Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." I can almost see her standing there. This guy is the one who did it. That you're second in command, your trusted friend or your trusted associate, whatever. This wicked Haman is the one that did it. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. This guy, if he wasn't so wicked, you'd feel sorry for him, because he had went from the heights to running the show, you know, and having everything done for him and all these things, to being pointed out as the one who was guilty. Well, then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And this guy can't catch a break now. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, "Will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house?" And apparently that wasn't his intention at all. But as he was talking to her, apparently he had fallen over the couch right on top of her, which left a very bad impression with the king. So this guy was doomed. I mean, this was it. It was awful.
That was pretty much...
That was it. It was over. As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now, Harbonah, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." What a twist. You can't write a better story than that. You can't. You cannot write a better story than that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. It's probably a good place to stop. But what a story. I mean, what a lesson about pride goes before a fall. And there's hardly anybody better in the entire Bible to illustrate that than Haman. This guy was so full of himself, so full of pride. And he had weaseled, you know, to deceive the king, sort of, to get those old Jews killed. And he got what he wanted. There was going to be a day when anybody who wanted to would kill him. And then he was going to take property and stuff from them. And I mean, it was going great. Then the queen invites him to a kind of a private banquet, him and the king. It was great. And then pow, how quickly things can change. But it was because of his pride. It's because of his pride. Well, we'll wait for them to get in here. And David will lead us in an invitation song in just a moment. One tremendous lesson from tonight's text that we read in these three chapters is how dangerous it is to think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. It's like being on a slippery hill. And boy, just a little bit is all it takes, and boom, there you go. And you know, when you think about all the places that warn people about pride in the Bible, I mean, from beginning to end, it warns us about the dangers of pride, of esteeming yourself so highly and putting yourself above other people and thinking you're so much greater than other people and better than other people. It's one of the most dangerous conditions or states, situations to be in. Because you don't think clearly, first of all. You know, when you're on top, you don't think anything bad can happen. That's what Haman was thinking. Nothing bad can happen to me. I've got it all. You know, he was all about him. I, and my. Everything was about me. And then just like that, it turned on him. That's the dangers, of course, not only of pride, but sin in general, because the thing that sin does, as we've talked about from James, it deceives people. It deceives people. And of course, Satan does that. Satan tempts people. And he deceives them into thinking something is good, when in reality it's very bad. And sometimes we can get hooked. And that's the danger, and that's what happened to Haman. That was what happened to Haman. What Jesus has done for us is given us the chance not to be condemned for our sins. You know, there's no condemnation now to those who are in Christ Jesus, who walk after the Spirit but not after the flesh. Romans 8, 1 and 2. So for us who are trying to follow Christ and walk in the Spirit, that means for Christians that we are willing to confess sins, willing to ask for forgiveness. And how wonderful that is. Let us think about these things, and if there is any need, we encourage you to come as we stand and sing this next song.